Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The Endangered Species Act is formally offered for renewal. Senator John Chafee says the new bill differs from the old. Save the habitat, and the species will survive. A conversation with the senator. And Larry Somke says, don't water, mulch. Don't weed, mulch. Don't spray for bugs, mulch. And Maurice Strong, Secretary General to the Earth Summit last year, says all the talk of failure is premature.
Even with its shortcomings, if we actually follow what was agreed at Rio, we'll be well launched on that new pathway.
These stories this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. Rhode Island Republican Senator John Chafee has offered a renewed version of the Endangered Species Act, itself scheduled for extinction at the end of this year, without such renewal. The bill was introduced with the support of Montana Democratic Senator Max Baucus and Massachusetts Democratic Representative Jerry Studs, support in both houses and both parties of Congress. Senator Chafee says his new bill is predicated on the original legislation.
And we think that the Basic Act is a very good act. These aren't massive overhauls to it, but they are what we consider to be improvements.
The original legislation was signed into law in 1973. Called the Endangered Species Act, it was, in turn, based on a piece of legislation dating to 1969, called the Endangered Species Protection Act, which in turn had been a reworking of the 1966 Endangered Species Preservation Act. Each of these earlier bills was an attempt to focus attention on the seriousness of extinction in both the plant and the animal kingdom. However, all of the bills lacked a really good definition of endangerment. The 1973 bill, needing to be renewed by the end of this year, clearly stated that a species will be considered endangered when it is, quote, in danger throughout all or a significant portion of its range. Today, Chafee says this is a good working definition, but is one that needs to be refined.
I think that what we need to do in under the Act is look more at what you might call the multi-species or the ecosystem. In other words, a very broad approach. Under the Act, you take species by species. And furthermore, I think that there isn't enough under the Act as it now exists to give warning signs to federal agencies or private land owners that this species or multi-species are going to be potentially endangered. And so what we want to pay more attention to are what we might call candidate species, those who are in trouble, they haven't reached the threatened or the endangered status yet, but they're close to it. And so let's take some steps now rather than waiting until the last minute.
We have in hand here a rough outline of your proposed renewed bill, and there is a curious line in it, what presumably later will be a full title in the final bill. To wit, you propose to create incentives for private landowners to conserve species by authorizing federal assistance for land planning. What does this mean, Senator?
I think that we want to have the landowners, the private landowners, partners in all of this rather than antagonists. The problem is now, if a landowner who might be a farmer, for example, with 300 or 400 acres, maybe 1,000 acres, will discover on his property an endangered species. And with that come all kinds of restrictions in what can be done to the habitat where that species is. And so the farmer will suddenly find that he can't plow right through some prairie pothole on his land, that water is very, very important to this endangered species that exists, or he can't plow to in areas, grassland areas, that where there's a nesting place for that endangered species. So suddenly he finds himself in an economic situation where he's deprived of some economic benefit of his land. And thus he gets antagonistic and angry, and frankly, in many instances, if he could discover that endangered species before the federal authorities discovered, he might be tempted to say, boy, this presents a lot of potential problems. I'll get rid of it and have done with it before anybody knows about it. Well, certainly that's not what we want. We want the private landowners to be partners and interested, and indeed many farmers or landowners are deeply interested just because they believe in nature and the preservation of these species. No matter whether it's a spotted owl, a black-footed ferret, or whatever it is, they want to help. And I think there should be some financial incentive to encourage though the private landowners to participate and reward them, if you would, for helping out in preserving these species.
How far are you willing to go, or indeed how far would you suggest that we as a nation should be willing to go to preserve a species, or even more broadly speaking, to preserve an ecosystem? In other words, at what cost is really the question? At what cost to bear the brunt of job losses, for example, that should quite likely be the result of protecting an ecosystem? How far should we go?
Well, it's not for me to sit here and say, all right, when you reach X dollars, we'll spend that much, but anything beyond X, go to it, that species not worth it. Frankly, I think that if the public as a whole and the private landowners and everybody realizes that these are all part of the web of life and they contribute to the benefits for all of us, so it would be a sorry situation, not just because of potential pharmaceutical benefits that come from some rare type of flower, but it would be a lesser nation of ours if these species and animals and birds and flowers that we see in our nation now were to disappear and be eliminated. We all worry about, say, the black duck population, which has diminished drastically, principally because of the loss of habitat. And the songbird counts are going down, much of that due to the habitat that these birds have sought and traditionally seek in Central America, or even in some instances, South America. So we can't put a value on it. Indeed, in the endangered species, there is no valuation. It says they shall be protected. And the challenge there is to find a way to protect them that isn't devastating to some economy, whether it's lumbermen or sawmills in the West, or whether it's to farmers in the Midwest, or whether it's to private landowners of in the East.
Mm-hmm. Senator, you just mentioned in passing there plants. What about plants? Do you have a targeted plan in the bill for renewal of plants? Nearly half, about 46%, I believe, of all endangered species are, in fact, plants. And there are many, especially botanists, who say that we have not provided for plants in the Endangered Species Act over the years.
I suspect that you're quite right, that there's a much higher concern evidence amongst the general population for animal life. Everybody can relate to the bison, for example, or to some type of a animal that moves on 4 feet, or rather than a plant, you get or a bird, and we all know what happened to the passenger pigeon, which darkened the skies in the early days of this republic. And then suddenly was gone. Had the last one, and then that one died, and there were no more. People can relate to that, whereas some kind of an exotic type of orchid or plant life, they can't relate to so well. That is true. But nonetheless, we try to do our best in preserving them all.
Mm. I'm curious, Senator, what are your personal thoughts, your personal convictions, a sort of philosophical view, if you will, of the notion of endangerment, of extinction?
Well, very worried about it. Of course, biodiversity, endangered species, all of those problems relate right back to habitat. That is the place where these animals live, birds, insects, flowers, whatever they might be. You've got to preserve their habitat, their living places, and that involves not only the actual space for them and the undergrowth and the trees, but also the cleanliness of the air and the type of water that flows through those places. If we found, for example, one of the major problems with the striped bass, for example, has been the quality of the water in the Chesapeake Bay, which is gradually improving, and the striped bass are improving likewise.
Republican Senator John Chafee of Rhode Island speaking to us from Washington on his bill to reauthorize the Endangered Species Act. The bill has been co-sponsored by Montana Senator Max Baucus and Democratic Representative Jerry Studs of Massachusetts. Senator Chafee suspects the bill will make it through Congress sometime during this session, which goes through next year. The wheels of government grind exceeding slow. The question is, can the plants and animals wait? This is Bruce Robertson. To ease your garden through the hot, dry summer, Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, says the best thing to do is mulch, mulch, mulch. He says he's mixed up a batch and is eager to demonstrate. Let's see.
Hey, there he is. Good morning, Larry.
You're here. What's going on?
How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine. It's nice and warm and hot and dry now, so I'm going to put a nice layer of organic mulch on my garden. And I've got a bucket here, you know, big old wash tub. I remember swimming in these when I was about 2 years old in the backyard in Iowa. And I've got compost from my compost bin. And I've got some shredded pine bark in here. Not nuggets. I don't like the big nuggets. But shredded pine bark and just a little bit of peat moss in here as an extender. And I like to use a natural organic mulch because it has a lot of advantages to me over black plastic or some of the other fabrics and products that you can use as a mulch. I like this organic mulch because of it has a lot of good properties, and it also has a nice look to it.
Now, Larry, what why would we want to put down mulch?
Well, mulch does several things for you. One, it suppresses weeds, so you don't have to use any herbicide. It just smothers the weeds, just simply kills them off by smothering them. Another thing that it does is keeps the soil cooler, which means that your plants are not as stressed during the summer. It retains moisture. It acts as a vapor barrier, I guess, and it keeps any moisture that you get either from irrigation or from the heavens, keeps it in the soil. And then because it's a natural organic mulch, and this is one of the great things about it, it will continue to decay. The microorganisms in the soil will digest it, and it'll go into the soil and add more organic matter to the soil, which that's the really a key to having a great environmental gardener, is a really rich organic soil.
You told us your particular sort of mixture here, your recipe.
Right.
Is there a particular formula that it works better, or could you put like grass clippings and leaves and that kind of stuff?
Well, if they're shredded, you can use, I think you can use grass clippings and leaves if they're shredded and they're blended. They make a real nice mulch also. You know, you should always use whatever is available to you. There's cedar bark nuggets. There's some people like to use these buckwheat hulls, cocoa bean shells, whatever you find to be your favorite from an aesthetic point of view and from a value point of view, use that. I use what I have that's available to me and what I've grown to like.
Sure. What about tips for applying it?
Well, you just put it on about 2 to 3 inches or 1 to 2 inches. I'm just going to take my shovel.
Is the thickness kind of key to
Yeah, you got to have a good couple inches worth on there. And you'll learn what your garden needs to keep the weeds down. Okay. And I just take it and just kind of shovel it on there and move it around. Some people are a lot more genteel about it than I am, but I used to shovel asphalt around, so I've kind of taken on that kind of habit where I just fling it. I once worked on the back of an asphalt truck, so... You know, it goes on pretty easy. There's nothing secret about it. And then you can get it up close to the plants. You don't want to put it on top of the plants, but you can get it up pretty close. And, of course, you would never want to put it on top of young seedlings. I have some, as you can see down there, I have some zinnias that are just now coming up.
That would smother them.
That would just smother them and kill them just like it would the weeds. Yeah. But a lot of people ask me, how close can you get it to the plants? Well, you can get it right up around the base of the plants, and it won't cause any trouble. Now, what you can do for a little fine touch here, you can see you can get down on your hands and knees and lift up some of the plants a little bit and just kind of with your hands
work it in
underneath, and then it has a really nice look. See, I have a rough look, but then I can go in, smooth it out a little bit with my hands, and give it a real nice look.
Finally, Larry, when you after you've applied the mulch, one of the reasons is for moisture retention. What about raining and watering the plants afterwards. Doesn't it take a little bit extra water to get down through the mulch to the plants and the roots?
No, not necessarily. And now this garden that I have right here does not really demand a lot of water, but if you have a garden you know you're going to demand some water, you may consider installing a soaker hose in the garden before you put the mulch in and put the soaker hose underneath the mulch. And that way, whenever you water it, the hose is underneath the mulch. But no, the mulch will not cause you to use more water. It will actually cause you to use less water because more water is being held in. It's more water conserving. And so for that reason, you get another environmental halo because you're conserving water resources.
All right. Well, I don't ever like to interrupt you too long. It's always best to get back to work.
Yeah, and I think we'll talk about this electric lawnmower next.
All right. See you next time, Larry.
All right.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener and author of the new book, Beautiful Easy Gardens. The electric lawnmower was sitting out on the lawn, and it really looks interesting. Join us next time. From Hollowville, New York, this is Bruce Robertson. At the United Nations recently, Vice President Al Gore spoke to the Commission on Sustainable Development, an organization formed in the wake of the Earth Summit last year in Rio. Speaking to the commission gathered for its first Rio meeting, Mr. Gore pledged greater future participation and leadership from the United States, a nation severely criticized last year for failing to take a prominent position. However, though he says governments will play an important role on the world stage, Maurice Strong, Secretary General to the summit last year, says non-governmental organizations, NGOs, made the difference then and will make the difference in the future. For an assessment of last year's summit now, a year later, we reached Mr. Strong in Toronto, Canada, at the headquarters of Ontario Hydro, where he serves as Chief Executive Officer for the moment. First, on the role of governments.
Well, obviously, there is no substitute for governments in terms of making regulations, making policies, and most of all, creating the system of incentives and penalties to which business responds and to which individual behavior responds. And one of the most important functions that governments now have to perform is to, in relation to implementation of Rio, is to go back and to their basic budgeting process and their own internal domestic resource allocation processes and look at all the ways in which their fiscal and tax and incentive policies are affecting economic behavior. They'll find that many of them are de facto subsidizing environmentally unsound and unsustainable practices. They weren't intended that way, but they are. Agricultural subsidies, subsidies to coal, subsidies that provide incentives for cutting down trees more than to replanting them, a whole series of things. Now, you'll find that the money is in the system. If they can reorient that to provide positive incentives for environmentally sustainable behavior. And they'll find, incidentally, that this offers also the most promising prospect for revitalizing our economies. We've been stuck in a rut in North America recently with the assumption that somehow that jobs and the environment are run counter to each other, that as long as we're having trouble with jobs, we can't afford to give the same amount of weight to our environmental concerns. The evidence we assembled for the Earth Summit really runs absolutely counter to that. Of course, there are jobs on the line in particular areas, but on the whole, far more jobs will be created by the transition to environmentally sustainable development than will be lost.
Though governments must sign and somehow enforce the treaties and the Agenda 21 agreements signed at the summit, and though the new United Nations Commission at which Mr. Gore spoke is a governmental body, Maurice Strong says we must continue to look elsewhere for the real movers and the real shakers.
At the level of people, it was really the people power that enabled us to accomplish what we did at Rio. We didn't have the leadership of the United States, as we've already said. No other country was in a position to substitute for that leadership fully. And therefore, we relied on people power, amplified very much through the media, because we had more media present at Rio, more than double as many amount, as a matter of fact, the number of media representatives that have ever covered any other world event of that kind. This meant that people everywhere were made aware of what was happening. And that has been translated into a tremendous number of people-based initiatives around the world, and initiatives on the part of important sectors. For example, engineers. I've just been party to the launching by the four World Professional Engineering Associations of a combined initiative which they call the World Partnership for Sustainable Development, committing their 12 million engineers members to putting sustainable development and Agenda 21 in the center of their own professional agendas. And I could give you example after example. And that's where the real results of Rio will finally be worked out.
Mr. Strong, we are here talking about the Earth Summit now a year later. You were Secretary General for the meeting, and which was formerly titled the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, UNCED. You had great power to influence there in your capacity. What did you come away with after the summit? Did you have a sense of accomplishment or a sense of disappointment, or was it unfinished business? What?
Well, I guess a mixture of all of the above. One on accomplishments, I think it has to be said that the agreements they actually reached there went beyond my expectations, given the political climate. Nobody felt that you'd have a once and for all quick fix of all the world's environmental ills. So this, I should remind you too, was primarily a conference on economic change. And economic change, in order to ensure the future of our environment and our economy, but nevertheless economic change and not just mere environmental change. So it shouldn't have been surprising that there were conflicts and controversies and difficulties, but as I mentioned earlier, the net result, Agenda 21 and the Declaration of Rio, do constitute the most comprehensive and far-ranging action programs ever agreed by the international community. So, I mean, at that level, at the level of what they agreed, I wasn't happy with everything. Obviously, I'd like it to have been, improved, but on the whole, I have to feel that it was a major step forward. Now, the real issue is what happens as a result of Rio. What do governments do now? What do people do now? What does industry do now? On that level, the verdict isn't in yet, but the evidence is far more encouraging at that level than it is so far at the level of governments. And I believe that the initiatives we're now seeing around the world, incidentally, at the grassroots level and at the level of individual sectors like business and the engineers that I was talking about, that is going to inject a whole new energy into the political process, and that in turn will ensure that these issues will be pushed back onto the political agenda, in particularly in areas where they may have been temporarily shunted aside. Even with its shortcomings, if we actually follow what was agreed at Rio, we'll be well launched on that new pathway. At the same time, of course, we can continue the process of negotiating in those areas that were left at too low a level of consensus in Rio. But if we just get on with the job of implementing what was agreed at Rio, we'll have made an immense advance in the right direction.
Maurice Strong, Secretary General to the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, the Earth Summit, in Rio de Janeiro last year. He spoke to us from Ontario Hydro headquarters in Toronto, Canada. The work of the summit will continue next September 1994 with the Conference on World Population in Cairo, Egypt. This is Bruce Robertson.
Political will is our problem now. We've got technology is available, can be improved, certainly. The resources are available despite our sense of being poor. The resources are available by redeployment of resources within the system. What is lacking is a political mindset, political will.
Well, that's our report on the Environment Show this week. Thanks much for joining us. Join us next week at this time. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Production, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 181. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.